Hey Matt Eric, Canadian
Hello,
Patriot,
Mark Anielski.
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 You have to say it like a good
It's a it's a tongue twister, man.
Anielski. Anyways,
Anielski. Ah, the accent
Anielski.
makes a difference, eh? Anielski.
Vancouver's Yeltsin, Anielski. Anyways,
It's good.
I'm sure I'm not. My inflection is not truly Polish, but got a German inflection. Good,
Are you doing?
you?
I'm okay. I'm
Good.
looking forward to this chat. It's an important one.
Me too. I guess just quick introduction. Who's Matt Arrett, the brilliant Matt Arrett, and are those books real behind you? Yeah.
Yeah, it's a digital green screen actually. I'm holding the wall right now.
Yeah, I want to know what books, because I know you're a well-read human being, so you must have some pretty interesting book collection.
There's some gems back there for sure. I don't know if brilliant. I'll accept it. I'll take brilliant. Why not? Sure.
You
So
chose
yeah,
to
there's
purchase them, so there must be a reason you.
Yeah, you know, some of them I rescued from garbage. Some of them are rescue books. Sure,
I was
my
thinking
next
about that,
list might
the
be.
other day. It's like, if I went into a used bookstore and asked for Lyndon LaRouche's work or something, I mean, it'd be hard to find. They're probably in a dumpster somewhere. Like, people would just.
I've seen a few in used bookstores, but yeah, it's findable, and luckily somebody went and scanned most of the books published by EIR and made them available, and every single Executive Intelligence Review magazine published between 1974 to the present has been scanned, turned into a PDF, even the ones going back to the 70s and 80s, and they're all available on the LaRouche Pub archive. And I always encourage researchers to explore that amazing archive, because there's just 45, 50 years of just amazing research that too few people have learned how to appreciate or utilize in their own research, but it's really good.
Yeah, yeah. If we had the attention span to actually read these days, but you are
Oh, God.
well read, and Cynthia. So I thought we'd have a fun chat about this notion of tariffs and the history of the idea of tariffs, and going back to pre-taxation even before World War One, and
Yeah.
and the current sort of ideas that Trump is proposing and which I think you would say historically are not particularly new. It's part of the narrative of the United States, going way back. Yeah, so love for you to like, I mean, I'm an economist, so I don't actually know. I mean, I know a little bit. I have an opinion about free trade agreements. I thought the first one was a sham because I was the analyst for the province on the forestry side of the U.S. Canadian Free Trade Agreement. And when I looked at it, I'm
Really?
like, I don't see any benefit either way.
Yeah.
I mean, this is not really free, whatever free is. And then I thought we'd reflect on LaRouche's ideas, and even maybe you have a different opinion of The Wealth of Nation, Adam Smith, but I have an interpretation of what I think he said about trade, and we don't, I'm so far from I think what he envisioned would be a healthy trade model for the world.
Yeah, for sure, man. No, it's like you said, the whole discussion in Washington around Trump has really forced this into the limelight, and a lot of people have had to reevaluate the whole topic of protective tariffs that they thought that they didn't have to think about since graduate school. You know, it's just not been part of our the discussion in polite society has revolved around the moral obligation of humanity to have embrace ever more free trade in order to do the right thing. It's sort of like this implicit general morality around the World Trade Organization, around the well, this goes back even to the earlier ushering in of the era of globalization, as a concept of deregulating the banking system, deregulating the corporate sector in order to really just let the hidden hand of, I guess, the supposed as I the worst proponents of this have thought about it or tried to label it, like, what is the hidden hand? Well, it becomes sort of the embodiment of the self-regulating aspirations for pleasure of the marketplace, of people who participate in the marketplace and their desire to avoid pain, and that sort of hedonistic calculus that is assumed that everybody has in their essence of being that formulates their decisions of what they want, what they're going to gamble on, what they're going to invest in, what they're not going to invest in, is all reducible to this very binary pleasure pain protocol,
Yeah.
which resulted in exactly what it resulted in. I mean, it's surprise, surprise. We started doing this in the age of Reaganomics and Thatcherism, and what you get is mergers and acquisitions out of the wazoo in the 80s and 90s, of course, and more and more license to speculate with other people's money, or not even just fake money, just bundled assets or bundled debt, right? Collateralized debt in new ways
That's like
of.
casino of, yeah.
It's just, and it all became good because people want to make money, and thus money became the means to its own ends rather than it being a means to a higher end, which is where you and I get along pretty well because we both see money as simply a tool towards a higher purpose in life that is not the money.
It's not the money. If money was tied to real assets, if monetary liquidity was tied to a bundle of assets and needs, that would be cool, but it is not. And so, can we talk about like this euphemism, free trade, is like saying, presumably it means good trade, but I think you've identified the roots, which I'm always excited about talking about. You know, a lot of these ideas come out of London, come out of the United Kingdom. And the British have been brilliant at sort of, I think, masterminding this narrative, in a way, going completely against, my work with First Nations suggests First Nations are always interested in trade. The first treaty with the Dutch was really it was a trade agreement in 1605, I believe, it preceded the British treaties, and so there was trade and mutuality. Same with the Chinese Emperor Qianlong, and when the British came and said, "We want a free trade with you," and my understanding is he said, "Piss off! Like we don't need your stuff. We're happy in our own nest." And then the British started the Opium War with them to, destroy the Qing Dynasty. So here we have going back, like, where did these ideas, where they emerge? Why do they emerge in terms of game theory, from your perspective of reading history?
Well, I guess the idea of free trade has two components in my mind, and I'd like to get your thoughts on this too after, but you have the ideal of what it promises, which is not necessarily a bad thing at all. And then you have like the intentions of political agendas that use it as a cover to steal and to destroy their targets. And I think that too often, because of this current phenomenon that has tried to split politics from economics in the last several generations, there's become an tendency to falsely have discussions about free trade. It's whether it's good, whether it's bad, without any recourse or any consideration taken to the role of political powers and agencies, powers and principalities that have been constant top-down influence shaping all of human civilization. And it's like you can't, because it's all about the context, right? Sometimes I could see situations where free trade would be a good thing, where you would want to have a removal of trade barriers between neighboring states or within, let's say, the United States, for example, as a whole. Like the US
Itself.
originally was 13 colonies. Each
Right.
colony had their own economic protocols, their own parameters of how to do things. There was no ability to say that after the War of Independence that America was a sovereign nation. It was the sum total of 13 colonies that had a general sense of grievance towards an empire.
Yes.
But you couldn't carry out harmonious action for the greater good. You couldn't do much that a real sovereign nation should be allowed to do. So in that sense, the fight to have a protective sorry, the removal of protective boundaries within and between the states after it declared independence successfully, that became a good thing. Because there was an overarching agenda outlined by the both the Declaration of Independence, but also especially the Constitution, that mandated that the country was going to have a purpose for the greater good, the general welfare of society. That would infuse purpose into everything. So there wouldn't be like one state that would try to destroy other states for its own benefit. Now, that's different from the global scene where you had the British East India Company trying to like manage a world empire, utilizing this idea that what's good for you is not for me. So Britain would always utilize, how do they develop such a monopoly on manufacturing that they were able to have become the alpha dogs, lording over dependent nations under their control around the world. And partially it was a lot of dirty plays, like
Right.
destroying the
Textiles
textile of
in
India.
India, or right, and yeah.
But then the other hand is they would say, okay, well, we have this doctrine that everybody is going to be expected to adhere to if you're going to be not invaded, as you pointed out, as the Qianlong Emperor discovered soon, which is free trade, where everybody has to open up their they have to open up their borders to total inflooding of goods that would, be produced by Britain, because again they took control of the things that India and other countries used to do for themselves. That would allow them by design to destroy any nascent industries in those target countries that would then be flooded by cheap goods, because then people could, the locals who were already economically suffering weren't going to spend $2 on an item that they could buy for a dollar if it was brought in. So that was a great way to keep people underwater. But then they didn't do it for themselves. So Britain was able to, their secret sauce for growing their manufacturing was that they would utilize protectionism for their own, growing manufacturing that they didn't even use very well, because in the end of the day, they were still following the money. Like, they were still using human exploitation to a disastrous degree, as we saw with Charles Dickens' novels describing, I think, authentically the living situations of manufacturing hubs in London.
The satanic mills of London, and
Yeah, exactly. So, in that sense,
which is
I
interesting,
think,
right? So what you're saying is even the idea of hegemony was partly poorly executed by this one nation. Can you talk about that, and that's brilliant. Can you talk about your interpretation of Adam Smith's Wealth of Nations when he talked about, when two nations trade, they generally would trade in their comparative advantage. So Portugal, if it produces better port wine than Britain can ever, and Britain produces better wheat, there would be a mutuality there of exchange. And I think that idea, and that ties in with maybe my question of LaRouche, Quentin LaRouche, is if in fact Smith was right, and I'm not saying my interpretation is correct, that trading in comparative advantage means you're trading in a sense, the natural advantages of the environment, the land, the ecosystem, which that comparative advantage comes from nature. It didn't come from your human ingenuity. And so there would be, I mean, we can't grow bananas in Canada. I guess we could, but be too expensive to grow. Why not just import them from Florida or Costa Rica or somewhere? So can you talk about am I right about Adam Smith? And if so, how did the British just ignore his ideas, or did they use his ideas to their advantage and play the middle piece instead?
Okay. Well, to
Anyways.
answer that, no, it's a great question. To answer that, or to give my answer to that question, in my assessment, I'm going to share first a quote, from Adam Smith, published in his earlier 1759 Theory of Moral
Book
Sentiments.
sentiments. Yeah, I got that on my bookshelf too.
You do? Okay. So I'm going to just take a small quote. I used it in a recent essay I published for my book series on the Science Unshackled. So I'm going to do that first, and then I'm going to say something about the deeper
So
implications of this.
just for the listening audience, hardly anyone's heard about the theory of moral sentiments, but some might argue that was his most important work. Versus nations, and
Agreed.
did it precede the Wealth of Nations or follow?
This is 1759, and Wealth of Nations was 1776 it was published, when it was becoming clear that the belligerent American colonists stood a chance at actually breaking away.
That's
So
right.
that's not, I don't think, a coincidence for the British publication of The Wealth of Nations. I would always look at the political agendas behind a lot of the things that Adam Smith says objectively. I don't disagree with, but I think that there's something higher about the political dynamics in the world that resulted in the British Empire, and some leading figures around Jeremy Bentham, who I think, sorry, Lord Shelburne, playing a very big role in deciding to amplify Smith's thesis at that time. And so before I get at that, the quote in question that I want to just read out here, and this is my paper, is The Universe Dead or Alive? Or Does Life or It's called Does Life or Death Govern the Universe? Part Three: The Newtonian Roots of Today's Liberal World Disorder. And so in it, Smith describes his view of how to judge moral good and moral evil. So what is his definition of that? He describes here that the administration of the great system of the universe, the care of all rational and sensible beings, is the business of God and not of man. To man is allotted a much humbler department, one much more suitable to the weakness of his powers and to the narrowness of his comprehension. The care of his own happiness, that of his family and his friends, his country. Nature has directed us to the greater part of these. Oh, this is the big part. Nature has directed us to the greater part of these by original and immediate instincts.
Interesting.
Hunger, thirst, passion which unites the two sexes, the love of pleasure and the dread of pain, prompt us to apply those means for their own sakes and without any consideration of their tendency, the beneficent ends which the great director of nature intended to produce by them.
Wow.
Yeah. So
That's
that, I think, gets it. What I identify, I don't see him ever having abandoned this moral core axiom that I think that was always there, even in his later writings around his building up of the thesis that he does in The Wealth of Nations in three volumes. That it's a hedonistic calculus ultimately underlying the decision making that humans are capable of doing for what they want, what they think is right or wrong. And it's all rooted in the desire for sex, avoidance of pain, pursuit of pleasure, and the considerations of the greater coherence to society, the greater good is up to God to think about, not for lowly man with his, limited comprehension capabilities. So right there, I see a lot of Trojan horses embedded into the matrix of his system. The other thing that I would say about Smith, and specifically The Wealth of Nations, again, it came through my readings of two people. Here, let me just hit stop here for the moment. Friedrich List.
like the composer list?
No,
Nope.
not
Another list.
Liszt.
Not
Yeah,
Liszt. Yeah.
Friedrich Liszt. I was looking for his book here on my bookshelf. But oh, here it is.
I love it. I do that all the
So,
time. I go actually to my bookshelf, like Friedrich Liszt or Liszt. Okay.
yeah,
German.
Friedrich Liszt.
German, Austrian, or no? Oh, yeah, German.
He was Prussian. It's called Outlines of American Political Economy. He was writing this and studying the American system in 1825 to 1830 when he was in America. He was part of the contingent of Marquis de Lafayette when Lafayette was doing his tour of the United States between 1825 and
Oh,
1830
interesting. So
before going back to France.
before Bismarck.
Oh, yeah. But his program is based upon his studies of what made America viable and good and survive its precarious early years as a nation. So he's looking very much at he's studying the solutions of Alexander Hamilton, how Hamilton was able to introduce his concepts of his reports and manufactures that united the nation under the Constitution, that created a national bank that would be organized and controlled by the constitutional mechanisms of the society and not by private financiers. Although it has been historical revisionism, even going back to the 1820s, already began trying to lie deceitfully to tell people that Hamilton was a Rothschild tool. That was going back in the 1820s, 1830s, these stories. But if you actually look at what the Hamiltonian Bank was that List studied and its mandate, it was how it was structured, it was never permitted to be owned and operated. You could be a private investor investing in it, but all of the directors by law had to be based upon the United States. The US had to be, the nation itself had to be a primary investor in ownership of the bank itself as an instrument for emitting the type of productive credit outlined by Hamilton, which allowed for the building up of infrastructure and providing loans to productive businesses that would do something to,
Hamilton is an important character because one could say Trump has some of those ideas, perhaps.
Oh, yeah.
Would you also say that, not to go too far off, but that Franklin, Benjamin Franklin, and Hamilton had similar views, like Franklin's Philadelphia experiment? Would you say there's a mutuality there of thought, or?
Like Ben Franklin's on the necessity of a paper currency, and his views on the nature and purpose of money as something that would drive manufacturing, trade, and general good happiness amongst people, but not happiness from the standpoint of the pursuit of pleasure, avoidance of pain, the higher idea of it, the thing that taps us into the purpose of life, which is to create and to be more and more in harmony with God's law.
Well,
That type of
true.
idea is very much outlined in Ben Franklin's views, and it's also very much clearly outlined in Hamilton's views as well.
Right. Well,
So yeah.
my interpretation of eudaimonia, happiness, as well being the spirit or soul, even though I've read everything Jefferson, I think you would say, well, Jefferson just plagiarized, but whatever. He did write a few things on happiness, and I thought even he didn't root it in the Greek definition of well-being of the spirit. But or neither did Adam Smith, actually. When I scanned the Wealth of Nations in my electronic copy, not once did he define wealth from the original Old English, meaning the conditions of well-being. I thought that was fascinating that he wouldn't even reflect etymologically on the roots of the word wealth.
Weird, eh? Well, that's part of Friedrich List's problem because he writes this in opposition, in a contrast to Adam Smith's Wealth of Nations directly. So that's sort of his foil in this book that he builds up a system that would be applied to Germany. He's the father of the Zollverein, so the German Customs Union. That's
So
he's the he's the guy.
which leads to Bismarck's unification of the German
You got it. Yeah. And
things.
so Liszt is incredibly important for Germany's to explain Germany's successes as far as unifying from competing baronial little, feudal states into becoming an actual industrially advanced, culturally advanced nation. Friedrich Liszt is sort of, again, the secret sauce in what made that happen. And his studies of America's example, as applied to the German situation, was super duper important. And his point that he makes against Smith and the Smith followers inside of Prussia at the time that he's in combat with is that Smith never defines what allows a nation to develop wealth in the first place. Like he assumes that there's already this thing called a world of nations with wealth as an a priori starting point. But it's like, well, why do some of them have industry? Did it just grow off of trees? Or like, how did you do that? So if you assume all things being equal, like mathematicians must, like that's how they start, like, oh, let's assume all things are equal. And it's like, in
No, it's
reality, nothing is ever equal. You have to first get at, well, how does a nation stand on its own 2 feet? And to get to that place where they have the ability to be in healthy trade and trade, freely, but in it with fair competition requires a combat to develop an indigenous manufacturing, which is where the fight is located, which is where Friedrich List comes in. And he's like, well, Adam Smith skipped all of that stuff. So he's like,
yeah.
if you're going to be able to develop manufacturing, you need to protect your local manufacturers, which means it's you need a field against all of the onslaughts. Like, there's bullets that are going to be coming at your little the farmers or the little manufacturing base that you're trying to grow out of nothing. You got to have a shield to farm it from the bullets because there's people who are going to try to shoot
Well,
at it and undercut it.
yeah, they'll undermine your grass-fed beef with Frankenmilk because they
Yeah,
can't, right? And
exactly.
then we just
And
got
so in that sense,
plasma.
protectionism is a very important part of the fight.
Yeah.
Otherwise, the little guy can't compete with the big guy who can always outproduce him. If you got a Monsanto or something, yeah, sure,
Yeah,
it's
yeah.
got like, yeah, like you just described, so many resources at its disposal that it could charge 50 cents what a local farmer might charge $3 for or something, So, you got to do that. You have to have incentives. So, like in Hamilton's case and Frederick List, they said, "Oh, let's also combine protectionism with different forms of bounties, like give people who can do a job, let's say build a canal, so certain people certain might have a business or patents that they want to that they, we could incentivize them so that they if they can do the job better and more quickly and competently, then they will get an incentive, a bonus, or a tax write-off or something like that, or like what JFK later on called his industrial tax credit. So for companies that were able to build the hydroelectric dams that JFK was doing, that was his form of Hamiltonian bounty. Let's give you a solid tax credit. You got the evil version of it that the oligarchy has used in more recent years under their Green New Deal
Yeah.
inside out version of Hamilton, where they're saying, okay, if you're a windmill company or a solar power company, we'll give you a bounty, we'll give you a subsidy, we'll give you a tax credit if you buy the thing. Which is kind of the opposite, because the effect of those kinds of investments under the Green New Deal doctrine is to reduce the productive powers of society. Whereas
Absolutely. Yeah.
if you go to the opposite, the earlier one of Hamilton, of Frederick List, of Henry C. Carey, of JFK, the overarching guiding light of what was value, what that was going to decide the incentives was going to be that activities which increase the productive powers of society, knowing that that increased abundance is going to create more space to support higher quality of li life, new potentials for new discoveries.
Yeah.
So all of
So
that's, yeah, really
let's
important.
play this from a fiscal perspective. I'm just gonna suggest, what if Hamilton was alive today and the president, not naming the current president emerging or sitting president, and this is again in a time before taxation, because income taxes were only introduced World War One, if I believe, partly I think to pay for the war effort, and people say, really? Like, say, yeah, the wars, both wars are long over, and we still have income taxes. But what you're saying is, if Hamilton played a kind of tariff model, it also it not only protected domestic production or allowed it to flourish and be maybe optimal even. But it also provide a potential revenue stream to government for other programs and services. So, you think about that scenario. What do you imagine could be, say, the future for the US if it played a Hamiltonian agenda in the next 10
Well,
years?
yeah, man. No,
What
I mean, that's a
what
great
might the
question.
US and other nations actually look like in your mind?
Yeah, well, but that so that's the fundamental question about, a lot of people they see the destructive dishonesty of the misused application of free trade on the global level that's resulted in things like NAFTA and other things that have destroyed so much of the ability of nations to sustain their own existence and the ability of people to maintain a quality life because we've outsourced our jobs to cheaper labor markets and these things. So they then go reflexively, and I think mistakenly, to the opposite extreme, where they start fetishizing protectionism as the magic wand solution to everything. And I would say that that's also a danger. And if people read Frederick List, or they read Hamilton, or they especially read Henry C. Carey, it would become clear that protectionism is simply a tool within the tool basket that is important to the extent that it can allow us to start walking where we don't know how to walk. So it creates that space for an incubator. But once you have like an increasingly competent, productive power in that society due to protectionism, whether it's now you have a an aluminum production system or whatever, you can
Yeah, you
produce.
can suddenly you can build all your appliances in Pennsylvania or
Well, now
Pennsylvania.
you can, yeah, and so now you can compete more efficiently. Now that you have the cap, you have the talent, you've built your talent. Now you can reduce your protectionism increasingly so that you can have fair competition amongst other nations who can do. And it's true, there, like you said earlier, there are certain things that some nations just won't do. Canada is not going to have a banana industry, so you have to be kind of flexible. We're not going to start pr using protective tariffs for our banana imports because we want to develop local banana, production. Like, that's stupid. So there, it has to be something that I think is seen as a simply a tool that can be turned on and turned off according to the deeper considerations of the need of society. And that has to be there. And that's why I get a little bit worried when I look at the configuration of economists coming in with Trump. And I think that Donald Trump authentically wants to rehabilitate the manufacturing of America. I think he really wants to have business, which is good, but at the same time,
Not
I don't,
overcorrect.
yeah, I see a danger of a discussion. Maybe it's just a negotiating tool to start saying like 100% tariffs on countries that work with the, or try to de-dollarize, or 100% tariffs on Chinese imports or whatever. Like, that type of overcorrection could also cause damage, a loss of faith in the US dollar. It could express a lot of insecurity. If the US doesn't have faith in itself, why should anybody else in the world have faith in the US? So that would cause potentially a lot of damage if you see it as a magic wand. But and also I like, you have to be able to appreciate the deeper material causes of what makes progress happen in order to then use the mechanism as a tool in a proper way that won't be destructive. Like, Hitler can use protectionism. Hitler can do national banking. It doesn't make like national banking and
But
protectionism are not intrinsic goods if you have a bad intention or a bad understanding of what the hell you're trying to do and what human beings are, which Hitler didn't have a sense in his mind. The human mind and its ability, its power of making discoveries and being happier, making those discoveries of the universe and translating that into new technologies that allow for the increase of productivity. He didn't have an idea that that was the source of value. And because he didn't have the idea, whenever there was the application of protective tariffs, it was to build up a war complex or other things that didn't benefit the world as a whole.
He could have gone into a completely different economic war footing than just going on the attack because of the Treaty of Versailles. Like,
Yeah, absolutely.
to your point, if he had actually known that everything was crafted in London, right, to cause him to ultimately fail again, never-ending wars, etc. But that's a whole other discussion.
Well, but also, like, he was a Malthusian. He gave orations in defense of Thomas Malthus. A British East India Company fake mathematician, like a mathematician who tried to mathematize human society and promoted the idea that human overpopulation is the greatest of evils and the purpose of government is to manage decreasing population. Now, Hitler believed that British brainwashing garbage, just like he
He did.
believed the social application of Malthusianism in the form of eugenics. He
Yeah, he
thought that
believed it.
that was like his religion.
Yeah, he believed the Slavs were slaves and so they should be annihilated and et cetera, et cetera.
Yes, exactly. So, it doesn't matter that you're using tools economically that could be used by a good person to a good end. The tools themselves are just neutral. It's a knife, it could cut or kill your neighbor. So too with protectionism or national banking or anything like that. So, on the issue of what you were saying about Trump and like what a good use of protective tariffs, what I hope the US moves into this directionality. I think it would look a lot like what Lyndon LaRouche had been putting forth. And I got a little quote if at some point, if you want me to read it, from LaRouche talking about protective tariffs, which every nation should have. That's the other thing. They only work if everybody
Every
is doing
nation.
it.
That's right.
Yeah.
And
If that's not there, it doesn't work. It can become very damaging.
So my whole thesis, my work has been to say that every nation, if it doesn't understand what its assets are, like most nations don't, actually no nations has a proper balance sheet, which is, that's what I've written about. I said, that's just a weird thing. It sounds boring. What does it mean to have a balance sheet? Well, you know that you have so much oil in the ground, you have so much agricultural land, and you've got so much permaculture, agriculture, whatever it is, right? You got a human population of 40 million souls with human potential. Those are all assets. And in accounting language, the issue is, are you achieving the highest utility of the asset, right? So if now you're managing Canada or the United States based on those ideas, A, it requires a baseline inventory of those assets to know what are the current conditions of well-being, which is what the word wealth means, of those assets. And then you could play it even in friggin' AI if you want, an optimization algorithm scenario and saying, how are we doing? Like, are we optimizing the agricultural land of Pennsylvania? Based on what? Well, based on yields, based on soil health, based on all kinds of criterion, in which now we could say that land, and we know, like, you've probably been to Amish countries, like, why do you think the Amish are sitting on the best agricultural land in Pennsylvania? Because they know it's productive, right? Whether they grow p tobacco or whatever. But so now we're thinking about how do we have a trade relationship of comparative advantage, basically a natural advantage, which I think is what LaRouche was saying in the physical economy idea. And so we can run this right this afternoon in the comfort of spreadsheets and say, like, so now the flow of, or the trade flows are based on sharing of comparative advantage, which are natural based, right? And so we're going to optimize full employment, we're going to optimize, well-being, if you like, all these other attributes. And yet it's amazing to me that hardly anyone sort of says, hey, that's a great idea. And I've sat at Treasury Board, I sat here in Alberta, try to have these conversations, and of course the blinders are on. Oh, we're just focused on maximizing GDP, and like, you don't even know what GDP is or how it's calculated. And the fact that I tell you don't have a balance sheet, that Daniel Smith doesn't even know how much oil is actually in the ground, or that it's not on the balance sheet of Alberta, has to be a big red flag when someone like her is thinking about sovereignty. And so this is kind of my question in terms of practical things that one would do if I was the head of Treasury right now, or assigned to, right? Or assigned to take apart the Federal Reserve and reconstitute like Hamilton might have. Any
No,
thoughts?
I think you're absolutely right. I mean, there is this basic elementary incompetence, right? And that's been baked into the specialists in the last several decades, especially where, like you see, your example is a great one. They're willing to make reference to things that they themselves can't even define properly, like GDP as the source of what's going to determine their idea of what value is. And yet something that they can define if they thought about it for 2 seconds, which is their own happiness and well-being of themselves and their family, they have a direct reference point by just looking at their lives, being
Absolutely.
authentic, honest people, they would have an answer, but that has become too abstract and thus nonsensical for their minds to even contemplate.
Well, Smith's quote, right? So we pay attention to butter and circuses and passions and sex and alcohol, whatever the addictions we feed. And we're not even thinking about the great director, who's actually the reason we even have the wealth, Luca Pacioli, is because it came from the creator. It didn't, we didn't, we inherited it. Like, it's a gift, and we're stuck at stewardship and pursuing something called GDP. And I'm like, I always bug politicians, like, I know how to stimulate some things, but how are you stimulating GDP, right?
No, it being able to, like Confucius said, define your terms is the first mandate of a scholar, is to first define your terms before you go out into a debate or an argument or try to change the world. Figure out what you're actually dealing with. And they skip those steps. So yeah, if you think about it from the standpoint of just elementary, and this is what I liked about getting to study LaRouche's physical economy, was his elementary his starting from the standpoint of no assumptions. Like, let's just look at, why is there an economy? Well, what is it that, and he starts from the standpoint of the negation of, okay, we're similar to monkeys from a variety of levels. They want pleasure, they want to avoid pain, they got like
They have
physical
basic
attributes that are
needs. They
similar.
need procreation, maybe. I don't know,
Yeah,
but
they need all of those things. So does that make humans monkey, and all of the monkey rules are what you need to understand to start organizing human society? Well, there's certain things that give us evidence that on a material level, we could just start on the material to satisfy the materialists out
yeah.
there. You could start by just looking at a graph of population demographics of a monkey population going back several centuries or as far as you want, and then compare it to the population demographic of human society for the past 800, 900 years, or even go back further as far as what we can gather. And you see, start seeing, well, right there, every other species, monkey, wolf, rabbit of the biosphere, has a carrying capacity. Their populations will grow, but they will only grow to the degree that the environment provides bounty. If there's a drought, the populations
Yeah,
collapse, the
carrying
mommy rabbits eat the
capacity.
baby.
That's right. Is there such a concept in the economy? Yes, there is.
Absolutely. It's there in ecology, and every it's there in humans as well. If
That's right.
there's limits that the world can carry, only so many of people at a certain, but it's different because whereas it seems to be much more absolute in the case of monkeys or beavers, like Abraham Lincoln gave a speech, it was his favorite speech on discoveries and inventions in 1859 in a debate with Stephen Douglas.
Wow.
And in it, he it's a great speech, and in it he goes through his understanding of the tool making of beavers, how they build dams and humans build dams. And he makes the point that if you go back hundreds of years ago, dam building of beavers is in no ways different from the dams we find in the age that he was speaking, whereas humans can improve upon their creation by making discoveries and thus improving inventions. That ran in direct contrast to the prophets of doom, the Malthusians of his own age, who were saying that no, we have to reduce our population now in order to manage the scarcity that's built into nature. And he was like, no. You got to encourage new discoveries so that we can overcome those limits and change our carrying capacity. Because it's like beavers, it's absolute. Humans, it's relative. It's relative to what? Our ability to make discoveries.
Yeah.
Your beavers are not going to do that. They'll just do what they do, and it's fine. It's good, but it's
They're
fine. It's
beavers are instinctual
yeah.
in, how they intergenerationally will build dams the way their great great grandparents did. Whereas we are in this always a state of right potentiality and in a state of even grace, if you like. But it's weird that we'd say, well, optimization doesn't seem to be instinctual to us. So,
Well, it's weird, eh? Because, like, yeah, kind of is. When you look at a baby learning language and learning how to walk or develop these faculties with no egos, baby is always like trying to figure out how do they do it. How do they see the these adults? They're trying to model what these adults seem to be doing. They admire it in a certain way. They're frustrated that they can't do it better, and they end up trying things out, experimenting, and getting better at it till the point that you can't get them to sit down and shut up, you know? Like,
That's
and
right.
so there is this like built-in optimization we see in its pure form, but then what happens if you've got a sick culture that the baby is going to be growing into as a child and as an adult? If that culture is sick, as in run by oligarchies, then there will be all of these, the sand will be put in the gears of that natural
Well,
flow, and they'll.
as I wrote my first book, then we suppress the response to the question, why? Like when you're 7 years old and you say, why, Dad, can't you afford to buy my G.I. Joe or whatever, my Lego set? And Dad says, well, it's too expensive. And you say, what does that mean? Well, I don't make enough money. Well, why don't you make enough money? I mean, you just keep going down that rabbit hole. But you never get that far. And then you get to university and you still have not been answered why is money scarce or whatever it is, right? And it's really amazing that we just kind of are in this state of that the why
Well,
is never being
that's
answered.
by design, right? Like, there's a John Locke actually had written about his views, as did Thomas Hobbes. Both loyal grand strategists of the British Empire. Their loyalties were always to the system of empire, whether it was called the Leviathan by Hobbes, or whether John Locke, who, whether it was the Royal Africa Company that he was a director for. They both wrote of, in John Locke's case, he called it faculty, the X factor is in John Locke's writings, where he describes the X as a symbol for what the managerial elite of society must not permit those they would lord over to talk about. Pertains to purpose, God, truth, design. There has to be, and he labeled it like the symbol X. It's like that's going to represent that whole verboten field. And we have to, because it's too dangerous to allow people to have disputes about causation, purposefulness, truth in its ontological sense. It creates too much disruptions. It's so we have to find ways to trick people out of that. Amongst those things is like the promotion of the theory that John Locke endorsed or promulgated, which is that we have human beings have no soul. We are blank slates to be written on by an
Which is
overlord
just
class.
preposterous if one, I mean,
Because if we have no soul, if we're just these machines, well, then it's true. There is no truth. It's just who can ever impose their definitions of anything onto the society that will then program the individuals to accommodate certain thoughts that are in conformity with the hierarchy of that society, which John Locke was a high level part of with the British Empire.
so
So,
I have another
yeah.
flyball for you. It's totally like from left field, but I just was introduced to this. Apparently, it's a man with the highest IQ in the world, a guy named Chris Langan. The theory of everything, or CTMU, model cognitive methods, whatever. And I listened to him on. He was interviewed by, I guess, the host of the Daily Wire, which we have our opinions about. I'm sure we'll keep it to ourselves, but. But I thought, this guy is like, what a character. Like, to your language, is this guy just a cutout or is he for real? Because if he's for real, he's a very interesting philosopher. And and he has this understanding of, he says, inherent evil is incongruent. It's just, it can't stand, right? And good or God is just inherently what is, right? Anyways, I'm simplifying his. He's written a big paper on it, but I was thinking this guy would be a really interesting fellow to debate, someone like you, or just to because I think he's got some ideas that are relevant to our discussion today, which is, well, how does physics, how does the whole universe even operate? He says, universe is continually expanding. We as individual aspects of the universe are smaller in relation to the expanding universe, and so. He agrees with like Einstein and all these other folks, but anyway, I just throw that name out for a future reference.
Is he subscribing to the cosmology that the universe is grown out of the Big Bang and is subscribe is expanding into the nothingness of the
Nope.
vacuum?
Nope.
Or what is he? Nope.
No,
He just means expanding from a qualitative standpoint.
he firmly believes God is God and that we are aspects of God. Like we are co-creating with
Okay.
God. So, but that the
Yeah.
fact that, and this is what I wrote about too, my first book's like, if the first, I call it the exhale of God creation, the ha expanding outwards like a breath, never always expanding, never ending, right? Which is almost impossible to comprehend. Like, what do you mean? Is this continually expanding? It's like, but that's what love does. It just expands, right?
Yeah.
Enlarges. And so like, so I kind of joke. It's like, look, I this guy who like I don't understand how this guy who's so smart got a 200 whatever, supposedly, and I'm even joke laughs like, who defines IQ? Who measures IQ of anyone? Like, is there a nice litmus test? Like, I don't know. And
Yeah.
but the fact is, this guy is, he tried, I think he wanted to work for the IRS. He couldn't. He ended up being a bouncer in a bar. He's a weightlifter. Like, he's 2 years, he's like this cutout, right? But it's, I like, either it's a very convenient cutout to have presented to the world right now, or he's speaking the truth. Like,
Yeah, send me a link because I haven't looked at him.
and I did, I put it through Otter too. So I've got the transcript of everything he wrote. But,
Okay.
But I think what I was going to quote before I go to my next question. Oh yeah, here is his writing. This is very interesting. He says evil about evil. The devil is incoherent. Sin is a big problem because it's evil, but it's also a big problem because it's such a waste of time. Evil is counter to good and the desire for all of creation to exist. That's interesting.
Yeah, I like it.
Incongruent. I know we've all been here about an hour or so.
Well, I liked on that note, for this irony of like creation. I'm a big follower of Nicholas of Cusa. I've read a lot of Cusa, who's a friend of Nicola Pacioli,
Trolley.
Luca Pacioli, Lu Luca,
Yeah, Luca.
Luca Pacioli. Yeah.
Father accounting for those who are hearing this for the first time.
And Kuza, his beautiful allegory for conceptualizing the nature of like the universe, was as a sphere whose center is everywhere and whose circumference is nowhere. But in terms of not being explicitly literal, as our naive sense perception wants to sometimes shackle our imagination, utilizing the tools of the senses. To imagine like the universe, does he mean the universe is literally a sphere? It's like, no, he does not mean that. He's using a language, an ironical language
An
to
inadequate
express,
language, right?
exactly. And it's implying more qualitative concepts or attributes of boundedness and unboundedness coexisting. Now, that could only work in a universe of creative change. Can't work if you imagine a static universe that's just naturally in a unchanging crystalline form. It doesn't, then it becomes like that noun-based idea becomes a self-contradiction. Like, how could you have a sphere whose center is everywhere and whose circumference is nowhere? It makes no sense. But if you imagine it from the standpoint of like something that is finite and unbounded at the same time, so it has a finite, there's boundary conditions that we find in space and in time. Within the realm of the becoming, the unfolding of the material creation, as Plato described the reality of the realm of being, the realm of becoming, coexist, but the realm of being, which transcends boundary conditions, like you can imagine, I see a square and I see that it has an identity and I see that there's an outside and an inside to the square with certain like right angles around it for them, but. I can't imagine the smallest or the biggest square. Like I can imagine it always getting bigger and smaller, but I
Yeah.
can't, but there's always a square that I can imagine is bigger than that one. So and I can't imagine a time when there was no squareness. Like squareness itself as a concept transcends the ideas of beginning and end in time or in space in that sense. So that's how Cusa is always organizing his Platonic dialogues to help.
It was Cusa Italian, like Pacioli, or no?
But no, he's German. He was
German.
German. Yeah,
So
he was German.
can we riff on this subject? Because with my accounting, but I think we talked about it in a previous conversation. But I didn't know, having studied accounting theory at U of A, I didn't know about, never heard of Luca Pacioli. But here he is, and with his friend Leonardo da Vinci, and this Franciscan mathematician writes Summa Arithmetica, Divina Proportiono, as in nature, so in accounting, a debit has to equal a credit, double entry bookkeeping, which he probably borrowed from the Sumerians, but that's another subject. But I learned from my accounting friends in Ottawa that Lucas said something really important, several things. One, he said, all wealth comes from God. I'm like, you mean well-being, wella? Because that's interesting. He did probably define the notion of asset as something that can, well, some of the characteristics, it is something that is owned or held, but also something that generates future utility. So, and then the other thing he said is there's no such thing as a profit with an F, especially in Venetian, Florentian, guild societies. But I'm really, what struck me about all this is the only reason a debit can equal a credit in the ledger is if the two transactions are monetized. So LaRouche's idea is like, what if you're dealing with physical attributes of two assets or entries that are physical and qualitative nature. And monetizing is useful because it allows us to compare things on equivalency
Yes,
basis. But if
absolutely.
you're now dealing with an acre of wetland and a human life with 700,000 hours of potential, like how do you square or how do you kind of balance and optimize in this kind of complexity of?
Yeah. Well, but so I think that the way LaRouche would probably respond to that, he did a textbook called So You Wish to Learn All About Economics in 1984. And it's a good book. It's tiny too. It's little bite-sized chapters. Do I have it here? No, it's here. So there's a this is the cover of it. So you wish to it's as
Oh,
you can
you
see, very
wish.
beaten. I've read this thing quite a few times, but it's
Yeah.
so you wish to learn all about economics. And he would I would say proposed an additional set of considerations to the mapping of the like everything that has physical value, right? So he's basically challenging economists to take an inventory, as you're proposing, of what are the physically productive value creating things agriculturally, industrially that exist, and the potential. So what's the hydrologic potential, the other energy resources that are very important that could be developed, because you don't want to do everything at the same time. You have to like create priorities. Some things you don't want to develop, like so there are certain rivers you don't want to dam. There's certain like things
That's
you don't
right.
want to. So you have to decide, right? But you have to do the
Yeah.
inventory first before you go there. And then I think you would also ask people to take an inventory of what is your industrial potential. So there's whole industrial sectors that may not even exist or that you destroyed by incompetence that we might want to build back, or new types that are cutting edge that we've never had that we want to build. So how do we decide on those things which are somewhat transcendental? They're somewhat beyond the limits of simply the considerations of the physical resources that exist at this time. So but mapping potential is very important, because that'll define like what type of educational investments you want to make. You know, like do you want your students to be trained in information sciences? Do you want a fusion energy research center in your school that you're going to invest in? Because but that means you have to have what's
Yeah.
going to be required for research reactors for fusion. Will you have to have a very strong like abilities to create tokamaks, as well as stellarators, as well as a very, very advanced electromagnetic superconductors. So
Yeah.
those are all industries that may not even exist that you then have to simultaneously think about slowly building. And it's like a garden, right? You have
That's
to go
right.
into the garden and do
And
things in a
then
certain way. You can't get it all at once.
yeah, and
Let's
you
say you
want to
want to
think
make
about transition strategies. Like, even if there are free energy devices, I'm not going to destroy the oil and gas sector in 10 years. I'm not going to do that. Even if, right, I'm sure they exist, but it would be irresponsible not to have a transition strategy that eases our way into this potentiality. Like, yeah.
So I think for the this is like you could build up a whole curriculum, but it gives kids something to hold on to if they're going to be studying this type of material. They're like, okay, I can act. It's not like GDP or some weird
No.
ephemeral statistical manipulation. It's like this is real. I can look
Yeah.
and measure what can be based upon certain, like there's a certain throughput of water in this river system
Yeah.
that could result in 2 gigawatts of electricity in this area, which could result in creating a manufacturing base or refinement capability that I currently don't have access to because I don't have one. I just extract oil, but I can't refine it. So, other things. So students could do that. And I think the core thing with LaRouche, like I was saying with this population, LaRouche defines something called in his system, is the potential relative population density.
Oh, okay.
So that's
Interesting.
like one of the fundamentals, which you get at by looking at these comparative demographic
Yeah, and it's
charts
a,
of.
as a forester, it would be a carrying capacity analysis. Like, if I'm looking at the watershed of Montreal, I'd say, well, okay, I can kind of assess, the Ottawa watershed. Let's say that supports the city of Ottawa. if I'm to optimize like within the carrying capacity of that watershed, how many people and whatever, what kind of economy could it support? But I'm thinking now in ecological scale, like watershed, so.
You want to think, about whole ecosystems, whole systems. Look at the desalinating West Coast salt water. If you had a few desalination plants, right, that could increase bounty, that could have industrial application, make things cheaper and more accessible for residential use of water, a lot more for farming. All of that farming, fresh water access can all of a sudden create increased bounty that's currently not actualized. So, like all of that idea of like thinking about potential, which is currently very ephemeral and abstract, but it's much more real than the real. Like the
It's
material that we have
very real.
is,
It's very, and it's absolutely possible. It's not.
like exactly. And it's like learning a skill, right? It doesn't, because I've learned, I went to school to learn farming. Maybe I don't own a farm, but I've built up capacities where if you now put me in an environment where I have a tractor, I've got some land, and I got some tools, I can now, that capacity that I've learned through work is something that I can, you will bear fruit in when I'm now like let loose and
That's
told
right.
to like take your power and make it manifest it now.
Yeah,
You know, if I, so with,
exactly. And maybe you never heard about permaculture, but you know you have enough skills in agriculture to go, oh, let's try this.
yes. Yeah, and you've mastered the techniques so that you can now play around and experiment. You're not all like rigid.
Right. Yeah.
Know, it's like music. You know, you if you learn chords, you do the grueling work of like getting the technical. At a certain point, you become freer and freer to be playful with those things that at first were like very arduous. They become more instinctual, like they become new instincts.
Well, I play the piano and I never have to look at my fingers. I can just play whatever I see on the sheet. You know,
That's a beautiful, it's a beautiful thing.
it's
It's a great,
incredible. Like what? I'm not as good as Beethoven, but whatever. Not as
it's
Buddha
still fun. It's maybe
either.
it wasn't fun at some point early on,
No,
but
it
it
was
became
painful. Like
funner and funner.
having a nun whack you with a ruler every time you made a mistake wasn't fun.
So yeah, just quick. So on the LaRouche thing, just to really make it explicit for people, potential relative population density is simply like looking, mapping out. What is the population in certain areas of the world? Each one would be different based upon the environment of that part of the world. Obviously, the Sahara would be different from, you know,
From
the
the taiga of
France.
Russia or something, or the
Yeah, exactly. So there's those constraints, but then you want to think of, well, what is the potential in each relative population area? So it's going to be relative to the area, but what's the potential density? In any part of the world, based upon what I'm doing or not doing. So, if I do things that decrease food production by, I don't know, like you could take any number of bad ideas that resulted in decreased food production, then that creates new constraints. The carrying capacity gets tighter, and there's less ability for that society to reproduce itself. And if you do things that are wiser and increase the bounty, then you loosen things up. You can expand into more of that potential. So the real is always expanding into potential. And what's
Yeah.
dangerous is that the potential can sometimes lower below the real. Like what we've been driven into over the last 40 years is an intentional, like our population has gone from whatever 2 billion 70 years ago or 2.5 billion to 8
Nine.
billion today. So it
Yeah.
looks good on one level, unless you think humans are a cancer, then you're like, that's terrible. But the physical population has been increasing, but the potential, one could say back in 1971, Americans had about 93,000 kilowatt hours per individual available of general electricity. Today it's down to 73,000 kilowatt hours per
Hours, yeah.
individual in society. So we've been tearing down our hydroelectric dams. We've been shutting down the means of supporting ourselves so that the potential has been lowering to the point that it gets artificially tight. Now your choice then is to do things wiser to increase that potential to get beyond what is real and eliminate the arguments of the Malthusians who are saying, oh, we're overpopulated. Or you could then just kill the people to accommodate the lower population, which is what the Malthusians want.
Yeah. Which
So
is,
that's sort of LaRouche's guideline when he's advising people on how to use protective tariffs or what way to think about a national bank's function in a
right.
system is you have to have that as your fundamental, in which then people can decide on how to
Well,
use this tool or that tool in a positive way.
so I think I'd like to kind of close on a reflection of what you see emerging with the BRICS conversations. We know that at Bretton Woods, Keynes had some other ideas about, which I think are kind of congruent with what I think is the spirit of the BRICS. And would you say that what the BRICS are attempting to do is actually align with what we're talking about, which would be to have nations have their own respective currencies? I'm not saying that that's what they're actually aspiring to do, but do you think that the BRICS platform could be a place of hope for our future? And if under some crazy wild conditions, America and Britain and Canada would actually find the wisdom in such a mutuality trade platform.
Yeah, I mean, that is my hope. And I look at some of the leading figures who are economic shapers, movers and shakers within the BRICS framework. And I think about people like Sergei Glazyev, whose work I've studied, who himself was a student of Lyndon LaRouche and has given some beautiful speeches honoring his understanding of LaRouche's science of physical economy. And he's the Minister of Economic Integration of the Eurasian Economic Union. He's a major player behind the scenes, who's been behind the negotiations of integrating Russia with the Belt and Road Initiative, Polar Silk Road. He's been a longtime advisor of Putin. So I hope that people like him, that he's got a broader network of very wise people. Probably, I mean, a lot of them are, not probably, definitely, a lot of them are tied to the Russian Academy of Sciences, which is different from the American Academy, which in America has very little influence on policy. In Russia, it is a very important policy driving
It's like
force.
in China, the Chinese Academy of Social Sciences, enormous
Yeah.
impact on
Huge,
economic policy.
huge. Yeah. So, and I know that high-level policymakers have endorsed Schiller Institute conferences in China, have translated the works of LaRouche into Chinese. So I know that there is has been a discussion around these concepts for many decades. And again, all of these things do fall back into my hope that I have that these wiser heads are steering things and not the lower caliber people within Eurasia who I also see are there. Just like I see lower caliber people, and I'm saying this in the nicest way possible, around Trump, or either incompetent or criminally incompetent or
Right.
criminal.
Or criminal. Yeah.
All right.
It's like
So,
we will know them by their fruits.
exactly. Yeah. So far, the fruits that I've been seeing coming out physically and measurably from Eurasian economic decisions have been pretty good, pretty good. And I see it as very compatible with the best of our Western traditions that we've forgotten, and for the most part. What was the other part of your question? I was building up to something, and I got kind of side railed in
Oh,
my
in
brain.
terms of like a platform for truly
Oh,
sovereign monetary policies,
So
in the
with
spirit of
Keynes,
LaRouche, right? Like, can you imagine that if the others also gain some wisdom and shrug off their narcissistic, psychopathic, whatever tendencies, embrace the wisdom. I would say the wisdom of what I see, what I feel is coming out of the BRICS discussion. That would be a great future for this planet. And
And I would caution people listening about Keynes per se, whom I think that Bretton Woods, what made Bretton, anything that was good within Bretton Woods originally in 1944 had more to do with Harry Dexter White than it did with Keynes.
Gains,
And in my, I did a, I had to do a deep dive on this to finish my book, a recent book, and Keynes is a much more nefarious operator in the story as far as I can read it. And he was, the treasurer of the Eugenic Society of Great
I
Britain.
know
He was a major,
he was incongruent. I mean, his letter of economic possibilities, grandchildren, which I've quoted, are
It's fine.
fine,
It's
like.
fine. It
It's
seems like
fine.
it's
It's fine. And when you say when any economist says usury is a misdemeanor, I'm like applauding. But to your point, it's like there's a shadow side,
I think he's doing one of these limited hangouts. I think he's trying to seduce people with a certain degree of moral common sense, but then there's an esoteric So behind the exoteric, very nice message, which you can get with Blavatsky and the Theosophists, there's so many like light and life
Oh,
and love
geez.
and goodness. It's like, yeah, I
Yeah.
agree. Sure. But then why do I have to then go, into a Luciferian, one
Yeah.
world government to get
As
all of these nice things?
my
Or in
mentor who told me to have a look at the Lucius Trust one day, and I said, she said, your goal is to identify the 0.001% that's off. I'm like,
Yeah.
whoa, I mean, it looks like 99.99% good. And I'm like,
Yeah.
wow, that's like a needle in a haystack, but let's do it.
Yeah, and you start seeing like where's the so all of these people like Keynes, who's or Locke, they have an esoteric and an exoteric simultaneous doctrine, one for their initiated inner club, and then one for the masses who have to believe a false story that might seem nice. And I get the sense of Keynes was in the inner sanctum. He was a Cambridge apostle, very, very high level. And he represented the interests of the British Empire against nation states. So even though he would often say nice things, his idea of the Bon Corps as, and you could say in some ways like the standard drawing rights of the IMF was sort of the creation or the actualization of his Bon Corps idea
I
as a
see.
sort of standard unit that everybody could exchange their currencies into to do balance of payments and stuff. But and then there are mechanisms which, as simple technical mechanisms, may or may not be good. Like national banking or protectionism, the Bon Corps idea as a mechanism may be fine. And there are similar ideas being rehashed in the BRICS multipolar economic structure that they're bringing online. There's all sorts of discussions about something like a Keynesian Bon Corps, but I guess what made it bad under Keynes was that it was all built upon a framework of enforcing a mathematical constraint on. He wanted to make it illegal to ever go into deficit spending beyond a very certain, very narrow, limited degree. And I think that's at the heart of the European Union's 3% rule, which
Sure.
is like totally arbitrary, but it
Yeah.
puts a constriction on nations to, let's say you want to build a high-speed rail network, but you're in debt. Are you not going to build it
Well,
because you're
it's
in debt, or are you going to?
Alan Brown's kind of commentary on this, right? And then you've been
Yeah.
on a show. It's like, no, if we want to expand infrastructure, we could show the history we did that. We created enough liquidity to
So,
build the infrastructure, and then now we have to maintain the infrastructure, replace it, so we could do the same thing we did in the 50s. So, like, come on.
exactly. Now, at the same time, does that mean unbounded deficit spending is good?
No,
No. And
no,
that's
no,
why
no.
things like MMT is kind of like a controlled opposition to the Keynesian
Right.
absolutely, like
Modern
Keynesian
monetary
absolute.
theory, right? MMT. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. That came about in the 70s under Hudson, Michael Hudson's promotion.
Yeah.
And it was like the idea that no, we can, there's absolutely no constraints to deficit spending. And it's like, well, yes, kind of, if you don't have the qualitative idea of what is creating the real value in your society. Like Keynes also had the same ignorance, which is like, if we make jobs happen, if the government makes work happen, it doesn't matter if you're building a windmill or a hydroelectric dam or paying somebody to dig a hole and somebody else to fill it. They're all getting. It doesn't matter that a lot of these things are useless or negative value, because everyone's getting a check and they're going to use that check to
Well,
go to
I
the store
mean,
to buy a thing for their family, to buy some soap and food. And the buying of the soap and food is going to create a demand that will stimulate farms and industry.
that's what the
Farms
Chinese
and
did,
industry.
right? I mean, if you, that's what the Chinese did when I was over there. Like, look at all these empty condos and buildings. Like, it doesn't matter. Employed, like, took millions out of
Well, that.
poverty,
Yes
and
and no. Well, there's a limited, like, they there. Evergrande did make some oversteps, right? Like
sure, of
they're
course, yeah. I
but
told them that too, whether they took my advice, but I said,
but it was part of a broader nation building program. So building up a lot of these empty cities or buildings was part of a much broader conception that they have of a 30-50 year program, whereby they're thinking, okay, well, we are gonna have to we do want to have new industries in these areas. We're going to have rail in these areas that we currently don't
yeah.
have. We're going to have workers and families and secondary, tertiary, spin-off industries that will support an economy that they're creating. So they're preemptively building a lot of residential buildings in
Yes.
order to accommodate that future growth that they've got baked into their strategy, which in the West we don't understand.
No.
So we just see things as a snapshot in the present. We criticize it. as being so short-sighted, and we don't realize that no, they're thinking on a much longer playing
Yeah,
field for
they're
the most
thinking
part.
like two, three generations out,
Yeah, and
potentiality.
these buildings are going to be useful for
Yeah.
that physically to be sustained.
Exactly. Yeah.
So yeah, that's our problem. That's on us that we don't get
No,
that.
absolutely. That's on us.
Yeah.
And well, thanks, Matt. That was a lot of fun.
Yeah, it was.
I know we could repeat this, but where do we read about you? You're all over. I think you're getting more and more popular. I had a friend from a minister from Washington State yesterday reach out to me, and he said, "I'm a 73-year-old, but I saw your conversation with Matt and Cynthia, and I'm like, I didn't even want that to be public, but I got more views, I think, than I have on my podcast. So thank you." But
Okay, yeah, dude, it was a lot of fun, and I think that your heart and mind are really tuned to something rare and good. So I mean I take a lot of joy out of these types of conversations, and the fact that we can go places, where it's usually very difficult to bring, as you've noticed, trying to get very very common sense ideas
well,
of basic morality and
but
ideas of
the truth is,
wellness.
nobody, we're having an educated adult conversation, and you won't even find this on whether it's Jordan Peterson or Joe Rogan, or like, as much as I like long podcasts, like, people aren't having these kind of conversations, which is just unbelievable to me. These are
Yeah, me
basic
too.
tenets of economics, and it's like,
Yeah,
yeah.
agreed. Agreed.
So Canadian Patriot, and Rising Tide Foundation, and
Yeah, CanadianPatriot.org, RisingTideFoundation.net. All of our books are more easy to find on CanadianPatriot.org. In fact, I'm going to be releasing a trilogy of books called the Revenge of the Mystery Cults, Volume 1 to 3, in a few days. Well, maybe about a week or so. I still have to
Awesome.
clean up some typos.
Yeah.
So that'll be available pretty soon. So
And you're
keep your eyes peeled.
self-publishing all this, right? On, through Kindle Digital, KDP or not?
They're people can get the paperbacks, either Kindle or paperback, or buy the PDFs, things like that.
Very good. Are
And
you batch printing, like when on demand kind of printing, or
it's
how?
on demand. And what I usually do is I just make a giant order, and then when people want to get a signed copy, or I'm going to a conference and I want a few box of books, I'll carry them with me. So we have a big inventory also of Cynthia's books. Cool. All
All right, well,
right, thanks,
thanks so
Mark.
much. Okay,
Right.
talk soon.